Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Basil's War by Stephen Hunter, read by James Cameron Stewart. The Brigade Will Advance, James Brudenell, 7th Earl of Cardigan, 25th October 1854, Balaclava, the Crimea. Prelude, Spring 1943.
"One lump or two, darling?" asked Basil St. Florian.
"Why, two, of course," she said. "I should think you'd know by now."
"The ruckus we raised last night was so intense," he said, "it turned my memories to vapours."
"Are you referring to the first bash, or the second?"
"Both were cracking good fun then, were they not?"
She lay back in the bed, and though by profession an actress, and capable of applying any emotionally apposite effect to the exquisite symmetries of her face, actually allowed a genuine expression of pleasure to occur, that is, before she remembered that one doesn't admit to such carnal earnestness easily, and adjusted back to simple, banal cinema beauty. Basil dropped the two lumps into the Claridge's fine cup of Darjeeling. How did they get it, now that the world was seized up in lurid politics and battle, and brought it to her in bed, where she lay, swaddled in sheets, her perfect heart-shaped face aglow with eagerness.
"I do hope you can stay a bit, darling," she said. "The war doesn't need you desperately today, does it?"
"It hardly ever needs me," he said, "and never desperately." An hour or so later, he was back in the shower, and then engaged in donning, adjusting, and finally perfecting his uniform. Captain, British Army, of the Horse Guards, a few measly ribbons, unimpressive, in an era when most guardsmen boasted sheets of bright designations of courage on their chests. One would have thought Basil's War was spent taking dictation.
"I must say," she said, "I find it so amusing that you do not take this war bit very seriously. No one-man invasions for Captain St. Florian. Leave that for the other chap. You do not have the hero influenza. It's so refreshing when all are rushing about, some few because they want to, but the more general because they have to, or be thought a slacker."
"I love king and country," said Basil, "but I do love Basil more. Someone has to survive to help out post-war."
"Good show. Larry's off to Ireland to scout for battle scenes. I'm soon off to North Africa to look fetching for the boys, but Basil will be... What is it again you do, darling?"
"I sit in an office on Baker Street. I am given intelligence reports from all theatres. I prioritise, summarise, and turn into narrative. The story of a day in the war, one might say. That document then goes to all field and staff headquarters in London, at what is now called 1700 hours, but used to be bloody 5 p.m. It's all very tip-top, for the bigger fish in the London pond, mainly sergeants who actually do the war. They want me because I'm a strong typist, I seem to have sound judgment, and I tell a good story. On top of that, my father's millions mean I'm not a red, and my reputation for frivolity makes a good cover, as no one would ever take me seriously. The best part, of course, is that I am free for cocktails most evenings and parties, such as last night at Lady Duff Cooper's, where I encountered Your Majesty."
"I am gratified," she said.
She rose, flashing her thin, nude body for a second, as well as the shiver of her auburn hair and the sparkle of her azure eyes, then covered up in a hotel robe. She sat on one of the Claridge's exquisite Louis XIV chairs, crossed her legs, and examined the teapot.
"It's cold. While you got heated up, it cooled it down."
"So it goes with tea and men, darling," said Basil. A phone rang.
"Oh, God," she said, "they cannot have found me here."
But she was disappointed to learn it was for him.
"How could they have found you?" she wondered, handing it over.
"Basil! Good Christ, man, where have you been?"
It was, no names given, only vocal recognition. Major David Binky Fitzhugh, 15th Light Dragoons, serving now as Sir Colin's aide-de-camp.
"I was unavoidably detained," Basil said.
"I'll bet that's a story. Anyhow, we've got an action this day notification. I'm afraid you have to go to Wicket, and so soon after the last one."
"I will be in shortly."
"Not Baker Street this time. Under the Exchequers."
"That big, eh?"
"Sir Colin insists."
"I'll be there in minutes." He hung up. "Another day at the office," he said.
"Don't sprain a thumb," said Vivian Lee.
Mission. That evening. The Lysander took off in the pitch dark of 0400 British Standard Wartime, Pilot Officer Murphy using the prevailing south-southwest wind to gain atmospheric traction, even though the craft had a reputation for short takeoffs. He nudged it airborne and felt it surpass its amazingly low stall speed, held the stick gently back until he reached 500 feet, then commenced a wide left-hand bank to aim himself and his passenger toward occupied France. Murphy had done many missions for his outfit, number 138, Special Duties Squadron, inserting and removing agents in coordination with the resistance. But that didn't mean he was blasé, or without fear. No matter how many times you flew into Nazi territory, it was the first time. There was no predicting what might happen, and he could just as easily end up in a POW camp or against the executioner's wall as back in his quarters at RAF Newmarket. The high-wing, single-engine plane hummed along just over the 500-feet notch on the altimeter to stay under both British and, an hour on, German radars. It was a moonless night, as preferred, a bit chilly and damp, with ground temperature at about 40 degrees Fahrenheit. It was early April 1943. The destination, still 2 hours ahead, was a meadow outside Sieur-la-Gagne, a village 30 miles east of Paris. There, God and the Luftwaffe willing, he would deviate from the track of a railroad, find 4 lights on the ground, and lay the plane down among them, knowing the lights signified enough flatness and tree clearance for the landing. He'd drop his passenger, the peasants of whichever mucky group was receiving that night, he never knew, would turn the plane around, and in another 40 seconds he'd be airborne, now headed west, toward tea and jam. That was the ideal, at any rate. He'd checked the compass at the apex of the Lysander's primitive instrument panel, and double-checked his heading, 148 degrees, east-southeast, double-checked his fuel, full, and his airspeed, 175 miles per hour, and saw through the Perspex windscreen, as expected, nothing. Nothing was good. He knew it was a rare off night in the war, and that no fleets of Lancasters filled the air and radio waves to and from targets deep in Germany, which meant that the Luftwaffe's night fighters, ME-110s, wouldn't be up and about. No 110 had ever shot down a Lysander because they operated at such different altitudes and speeds, but there had to be a first time for everything. Hunched behind him, Basil was cold against the rush of chilled wind through various gaps in the Lysander's somewhat haphazard engineering, shivering despite an RAF sheepskin over an RAF aircrew jumpsuit over a black wool suit of shabby pre-war French manufacture. He sat uncomfortably squashed on a parachute, which he hadn't bothered to put on. Yet more chilled wind beat against him, because on some adventure or another the Lysander's left window had been shot out, and nobody had got around to replacing it. He felt vibrations as the unspectacular Bristol Mercury 12 engine ground away against the cold air, its energy shuddering through all the spars, struts, and tightened canvas of the aircraft.
"Approaching Channel 9, sir,"
came the crackle of voice from the earphones he wore, since there was entirely too much noise for pilot and passenger to communicate without it.
10 minutes to the water."
"Got it, Murphy, thanks," he said. "By the way, how's the new chap working out?"
"Quite splendidly, sir. We get the best at 138. It said Prime Minister himself sees to it."
"One forgets. Is he a Pole or a Norwegian?"
"Why, sir, he's neither, being a Hertfordshire lad. How did you know we had a new chap on the crew?"
"There's always a new chap, then, isn't there? I do worry he's being carefully supervised. Maybe he forgets to put a spanner to a certain screwhead and we fall out of the sky and into Jerry's lap."
"Oh, sir, I shouldn't worry. The boys go over the plains like the bad nurse who puts her finger into every open hole. Nothing gets by them. The planes may look beaten down, but inside, where it counts, they're in perfect running order."
"Excellent. Thus assured, I wonder if you'll pardon me if I take a bit of nap."
He awoke 20 minutes later, and inclining toward the intact window to his starboard, he could see the black surface of the channel at high chop, the water seething and shifting under the powerful blast of cold early spring winds. It somehow caught enough illumination from the stars to gleam a bit, though without romance or beauty. It simply reminded him of unpleasant things and his aversion to large bodies of the stuff, which to him had but 3 effects. It made one wet, it made one cold, or it made one dead. All 3 were to be avoided. In time, a dark mass protruded upon the scene, sliding in from beyond to meet the sea.
"Murphy, is that France?"
"It is indeed, sir."
"You know, I didn't bother to look at the flight plan. What part of France?"
"Normandy, sir. Jerry's building forts there to stop an invasion."
"If I recall, there's a peninsula to the west, and the city of Cherbourg at the tip."
"Yes, sir."
"Tell me, if you veered toward the west, you'd cross the peninsula. With no deviation, then, you'd come across coastline."
"Yes, sir."
"And from that coastline, knowing you were to the western lee of the Cherbourg Peninsula, you could easily return home on dead reckoning, that is, without a compass, am I right?" Basil leaned forward, holding his Browning 380 automatic pistol. He fired once, the pistol jumping, the flash filling the cockpit with a flare of illumination, the spent casing flying away, the noise terrific.
"Good Christ!" yelped Murphy. "What the bloody hell? Are you mad?"
"Quite the opposite, old man," said Basil. "Now do as I suggested, veer westerly, cross the peninsula, and find me coastline."
Murphy noted that the bullet had hit the compass spang on, shattered its glass, and blown its dial askew and its needle arm into the ethers. Briefing earlier that afternoon.
"Basil, how's the drinking?" the general asked.
"Excellent, sir," Basil replied. "I'm up to 7, sometimes 8 whiskies a night."
"Splendid, Basil," said the general. "I knew you wouldn't let us down." "See here," said another general. "I know this man has a reputation for wit, as it's called, but we are engaged in serious business, and the levity, perhaps appropriate to the officer's mess, is most assuredly inappropriate here. There should be no laughing here, gentlemen. This is the war room."
Basil sat in a square, dull space far underground. A few dim bulbs illuminated it, but showed little except a map of Europe pinned to the wall. Otherwise, it was featureless. The table was large enough for at least a dozen generals, but there were only three of them. Well, one was an admiral and a civilian, all sitting across from Basil. It was rather like orals at Magdalen, had he bothered to attend them. The room was buried beneath the exchequers in Whitehall, the most secret of secret installations in wartime Britain. Part of a warren of other rooms, some offices for administrative or logistical activities, a communications room, some sleeping or eating quarters, it was the only construction in England that might legitimately be called a lair. It belonged under a volcano, not a large office building. The Prime Minister would sit in this very place with his staff and make the decisions that would send thousands to their deaths in order to save the 10,000s. That was the theory, anyway, and that also is why it stank so brazenly of stale cigar.
"My dear sir,"
said the general with whom Basil had been discussing his drinking habits,
"when one has been shot at, beaten, tortured, tossed out of windows, and near drowned for the benefit of the crown as many times as Captain St. Florian, one has the right to set the tone of the meeting that will most certainly end up getting him shot at a lot more. Unless you survived the first day on the Somme, you cannot compete with him in that regard."
The other general muttered something murky, but Basil hardly noticed. It really did not matter, and since he believed himself doomed whatever happened, he now no longer listened to those who did not matter. The general who championed Basil turned to him, his opposition defeated. His name was Sir Colin Gubbins, and he was head of the outfit to which Basil belonged, called by the rather dreary title the Special Operations Executive, as distinct from either of the MIs, 5 or 6. Its mandate was to set Europe ablaze, as the Prime Minister had said when he invented it, and emphasized when General Gubbins was promoted to its operational leader. It was the sort of organization that would have welcomed Jack the Ripper to its ranks, possibly even promoted, certainly decorated him. It existed primarily to destroy people, places, things, anything that could be destroyed. Whether all this was just mischief for the otherwise unemployable or long-term strategic wisdom was as yet undetermined. It was up for considerable debate among the other intelligence agencies. The outfit was headquartered in a shabby warren of offices, 4 stories of them over a now-empty department store at 64 Baker Street in North London. It looked dissolute, dilapidated, sheathed in squalor, resembling a failing insurance company. But this meeting had been removed beyond the auspices of those wretched headquarters, although these headquarters were just as wretched. As for the fourth man across the table, he looked like a question on a quiz. Which one does not belong? He was a good 30 years younger than the 2 generals and the admiral, and hadn't, as had they, one of those heavy-jowled, authoritarian faces. He was rather handsome in a weak sort of way, like the fellow who always plays Freddy in any production of Pygmalion, and he didn't radiate, as did the men of power. Yet here he was, a lad among the Neanderthals, and the others seemed in small ways to defer to him. Basil wondered who the devil he could be, but he realized he would find out sooner or later.
"You've all seen Captain St. Florian's record, highly classified as it is. He is one of our most capable men, since coming over from 6 at the very start.
If this thing can be done, he's the one who can do it. I'm sure, before we proceed, the captain would entertain any questions of a general nature.
I seem to remember your name from the cricket fields, St. Florian, said the admiral. Were you not a batsman of some renown in the late 20s?
I have warm recollections of good innings at both Eton and Magdalen, said Basil.
Indeed, said the admiral. I've always said that sportsmen make the best agents. The playing field accustoms them to arduous action, quick, clever thinking, and decisiveness.
I hope, however, said the general, you've left your sense of sporting fair play far behind. Jerry will use it against you any chance he gets.
I killed a Shanghai gangster with a cricket bat, sir. Would that speak to the issue?
Eloquently, said the general.
What did your people do, Captain? Asked the admiral.
He manufactured something, said Basil. It had to do with automobiles, as I recall.
A bit hazy, are we?
It's all rather vague. I believe that I worked for him for a few months after coming down. My performance was rather disappointing. We parted on bad terms. He then got me a job with a friend managing a chateau vineyard, but, alas, I also exploded that. Thus he wangled me a commission. I did not prosper at first. He died before I righted myself.
To what do you ascribe your failure to succeed in business and please your poor father?
I am too twitchy to sit behind a desk, sir. My bum, pardon the French, gets all buzzy if I am in one spot too long. Then I drink to kill the buzz and end up in the cheap papers.
I seem to recall, the admiral said, something about an actress, 31, 32, was that it?
I do like actresses, Basil said.
Basil has, shall we say, had a somewhat eventful career before he came to us at Baker Street. His nightmares would be his best curriculum vitae.
All right. Professionally, he seems capable. Let's get on with it, Sir Colin.
Yes, said Sir Colin. Where to begin, where to begin? It's rather complex, you see, and someone important has demanded that you be apprised of all the nuances before you decide to go.
Sir, I could save us all a lot of time. I hereby officially volunteer.
See, there's a chap with spirit, said the admiral.
It's merely that his bum is twitchy, said the general.
Not so fast, Basil. I insist that you hear us out, said Sir Colin. And so does the young man at the end of the table. Is that not right, Professor?
It is, said the young fellow.
All right, sir, said Basil.
It's a rather complex, even arduous story. Please ignore the twitchy bum and any need you may have for whisky. Give us your best effort.
I shall endeavour, sir.
Excellent. Now, let me see. Oh, yes, I think this is how to start. Do you know the path to Jesus?
Mission. Another half hour flew by, lost to the rattle of the plane, the howl of the wind, and the darkness of occupied France below. At last, Murphy said over the intercom,
"Sir, the west coast of the Cherbourg Peninsula is just ahead. I can see it now."
"Yes, I can see that. All right, then. Perhaps drop me in a river from a low altitude?"
"Sir, you'd hit the water at over 100 miles per hour and bounce like a billiard ball off the bumper. Every bone would shatter."
"Well, that won't do. I suppose, then, it's the parachute."
"Yes, sir." "Have you had training?"
"Scheduled several times.
but I always managed to come up with an excuse. I could see no sane reason for abandoning a perfectly fine airplane in flight. That was then, however, and now, alas, is now. Basil shed himself of the RAF fleece and felt the coldness of wind and temperature bite him hard. He shivered. He hated the cold. But he continued stripping, shedding the RAF ground crew onesie. Even colder. He struggled with the straps of the parachute upon which he was sitting. He found the going rather rough. It seemed he couldn't quite get the left shoulder strap buckled into what appeared to be the strap nexus, a circular lock-like device which was affixed to the right shoulder strap in the centre of his chest. He passed on that, went right to the thigh straps, which seemed to click in admirably, but then noticed he had the two straps in the wrong slots and couldn't get the left one undone. He applied extra effort and was able to make the correction. "I say, how long has this parachute been here? It's all musty and stiff."
"Well, sir, these planes aren't designed for parachuting. Their brilliance is in the short take-off and landing drills. Perfect for agent inserts and fetches. So, no, I'm afraid nobody has paid much attention to the parachute."
"Damn thing. I'd have thought you RAF buckers would have done better. Battle of Britain, the few, all that sort of thing."
"I'm sure the chutes on Spitz and Hurricanes were better maintained, sir. Allow me to make a formal apology to the intelligence services on behalf of 138 Squadron, Royal Air Force."
"Well, I suppose it'll have to do," sniffed Basil. Somehow, at last, he managed to get the left strap snapped in approximately where it belonged, but he had no idea if the thing was too tight or too loose, or even right side up. Oh, well, one did what one must. Up, up, and play the game. "Now, I'm not telling you your job, Murphy, but I think you should go lower so I won't have so far to go."
"Quite the opposite, sir. I must go higher. The chute won't open fully at 300. It's a 500 minimum, 600 far safer. At 300 or lower, it's like dropping a pumpkin on a sidewalk. Very unpleasant sound, lots of splash, splatter, puddle and stain. Wouldn't advise a bit of it, sir."
This is not turning out at all as I had expected.
"I'll buzz up to 600. Sir, the trick here is that when you come out of the aeroplane, you must keep hunched up in a ball. If you open up, your arms and legs and torso will catch wind and stall your fall, and the tail rudder will cut you in half or at least break your spine."
"Egad," said Basil.
"I'll bank hard left to add gravity to your speed of descent, which puts you in good shape, at least theoretically, to avoid the tail."
"Not sure I care for theoretically."
"There's no automatic deployment on that device also. You must, once free of the plane, pull the ripcord to open the chute. Cord with D-ring, across chest."
"I shall try to remember," said Basil.
"If you forget, it's the pumpkin phenomenon, without doubt."
"All right, Murphy. You've done a fine job briefing me. I shall have a letter inserted in your file. Now, shall we get this nonsense over with?"
"Yes, sir. You'll feel the plane bank. You should have no difficulty with the door. Remember to take off earphones and throat mic, and I'll signal go. Just tumble out. Ripcord, and down you go. Don't brace hard in landing. You could break or sprain something. Try and relax. It's a piece of cake."
"Very well done, Murphy."
"Sir, what should I tell them?"
"Tell them anything you want to avoid a flap. That's all. I'll happily be the villain. Once I pranked the compass, it was either do as I say or head home. On top of that, I outrank you."
"Yes, sir."
Basil felt the subtle, then stronger pull of gravity, as Murphy pulled the stick back and the plane mounted toward heaven.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?